wanting to do a big, beautiful abundance panel for a very long time, but it was worth the wait because we have an all-star panel aligned for you today. We have Isabella Weber, a professor and economist at University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of How China Escaped Shock Therapy with us today. We have Aaron Regenberg, climate accountability director and lawyer at Public Citizens and a former Rhode Island state rep. And last but not least, Sandeep Vahisan, who is the legal director at Open Markets Institute and author of Democracy and Power, History of Electrification in the United States. Welcome to you all.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so you all came across MyRadar because at various points you all wrote reviews of the Ezra Klein and Daniel Thompson book, Abundance, that caused some degree of backlash response on the internet. I think I said Daniel Thompson, I meant Derek Thompson. And I want to start by setting this up for folks who might not somehow have learned that much about Abundance, which is probably the rare listener at this point. The discourse has been churning for months now. But I want to start with you, Sandeep, because your review in Boston Review Books got a lot of engagement from the authors of Abundance themselves and did a really good job, I think, setting up what the book Abundance is about and what the left's principal criticisms with it are. So how about you start us off?
Sure. Yeah, so I'll start by saying I share the broad objectives of the authors. We want abundant, affordable housing. We want abundant, clean energy. We want abundant, high-quality broadband. So I'm not really disputing the goals that they want. Rather, my view is the policy program that they outline in the book, which can be summarized as lifting public controls on land use and channeling more subsidies to corporations, among others, will deliver abundance. And my view is it will not deliver abundance. There's actually abundant empirical research showing that the reform program may help at the margins, might augment the housing stock a little bit, might increase our supply of clean energy a little bit, but the empirical research says it's not actually going to get us to where we need to be. We need a radically different program than what the authors lay out. So I kind of kick the tires on the claims in the book. So for instance, will zoning reform unleash investment in housing? I'm sympathetic to the cause of zoning reform. I think it's especially needed in a lot of affluent majority white suburbs, but simply lifting zoning restrictions is not going to deliver affordable, high quality housing to all Americans. There's a great deal of literature on this. A number of cities and localities have tried to do this, and the results so far have been fairly modest. On the clean energy side of things, Klein and Thompson home in on environmental review. They argue that environmental review is holding up investment in solar, wind, geothermal, as well as the long-distance transmission lines that we need to move electricity from, for example, the Great Plains to the Twin Cities and Chicago. And once again, the empirical research says environmental review is not perfect. There are instances of environmental review taking too long, but on average, it's working fine. People study the environmental and social impacts before they dig. That's done often in months, rarely in years, and it's not the principal barrier to abundant clean energy. And so I think the empirical problems in the book kind of expose the fundamental blind spot of Klein and Thompson, which is they don't really address the pathologies of contemporary capitalism, which are overwhelmingly focused on short-termism and extraction. Instead, they assume that capitalists have the sort of animalistic urge to build stuff. And I think that's fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, I want to be really clear for those who haven't read the book, what kind of impression you get and why it is, I think, that the priorities of the book triggered the left the way that it did. I think all of you in your various reviews contend with this idea that the left is having a knee-jerk reaction, because that's the framing that we've gotten from both Klein and Thompson, that the left is somehow being unserious, that they don't have an alternative story for how to deal with the real problem of insufficient housing. How could anybody really be against abundance? There was a lot of backlash to Jeffrey Teachout's appearance on Ezra Klein's very popular podcast, where some folks didn't feel like she was representing an alternative perspective of the left, or that she was unresponsive to Ezra Klein's specific questions about what they want in the alternative. And I think some of that missed the point of what exactly is so triggering for folks on the left about the priorities of the book as they come across when you read them. So I want to give Isabella or Aaron, if you want to take a stab at nailing what it is that doesn't just feel like sort of a misstep or a difference in kind of policy priorities, but something a little bit more dangerous than that.
I'm happy to take part of that. And I think Sandeep did a great job just laying out the ways that there's a substantive failure here, in part because if corporate greed and profit seeking is a big part of what creates scarcity in this country, as I think all of us would agree, then if you're writing that out of the story, which the abundance program does in sort of every way, be missing a lot of the solutions that we need. Putting the substance aside, the political backlash is based on not imagined, but just a listening to what the advocates of abundance are saying. They're very self-conscious in framing this, not as simply a sort of on the margins. These are a bunch of mostly, by the way, local. This like local decision-making is where a lot of these things that they are proposing should be happening. And if they're just saying, yeah, we should do zoning reform, we should do some of these other things, I think as Sandeep said, there could the It's not like a huge problem. It doesn't get us everything we need. It maybe obscures some of the real problems here, but like maybe there's some marginal improvements. It's not the end of the world. The problem is that they are very clearly, explicitly framing this not as some marginal local solutions, but as a national program for the Democratic Party. Derek Thompson has been very explicit saying that the project of the book is about setting up a fight for the future of the Democratic Party. Jonathan Chait just had a piece in The Atlantic where he explicitly says this is about the coming civil war in the Democratic Party. He says, quote, "Progressives are not wrong to see the abundance agenda as a broader attack on their movement." And for me, the concern is particularly acute in this moment because, and we might have a debate or argument about the redeemability of the Democratic Party, but from my perspective, it is incredibly important if we're going to beat fascism, if we are going to win a future where our kids can live, that we have a populist remake of the Democratic Party, that we have, in the same way that the Republicans, that Trump and MAGA, and before that, the Tea Party took over the Democratic Party, that the Republican Party, that we make the Democratic Party a party that is actually fighting for working people and taking on corporations and billionaires, the fighting oligarchy frame that Bernie has been putting out there and that we've seen is the most exciting thing among regular voters right now, is clearly the best antidote to a Trump administration that is the clear embodiment of the oligarchy, right? And so what abundance is doing that is so concerning to me is they are saying, this is the future of the Democratic Party. This is what our National Democratic Party should be doing. And I think there's like a less conspiratorial and a more conspiratorial reason to be concerned about that. The less conspiratorial is just that what they're putting out there is a bad political program. Even if there's not like a larger agenda, ulterior motives behind it, zoning reform is not what's going to beat Trump. It's not a compelling argument, political narrative for this moment. It reinforces and reifies a lot of the Trump, Elon Musk, Doge frame and narrative of we need to cut red tape and fraud and abuse without proposing like a strong alternative for what our Democratic Party is. It's an agenda that even the good parts of it are controversial. If you're going to push local zoning reform, you're going to lose some voters. And that's a thing that we think maybe needs to happen. Single payer, you're going to piss off, taking on Big Pharma or whatever, you're going to piss off some people. You might lose some voters. You're going to gain a lot more. But, you know, Ezra Klein, Derek Thompson, these are people who say we can't take on those things because they're controversial. Abundance is going to be controversial, but I don't think it actually wins us back those voters, right? Even in the best case scenario, you do their whole, let's say, housing affordability program. Maybe over the course of like 5 or 10 years, it has some substantive impact in some places. That impact is not going to be clearly felt, right? It's going to be not like the prices go down, but the prices go up by less than they would have. And for like an average working class voter to say this happened because 10 years ago, Democrats were doing that, like that's not going to gain us the voters that it will lose. So I think it is just a strategic disaster if for us to say this is what the Democratic Party's national program should be. And then I'll shut up. I've been talking a while, but the more conspiratorial concern here, and when I say conspiracy, I don't mean like it's less likely to be the case because we know there's lots of conspiracies in our politics that are very real. But the more conspiratorial concern is that there's a bunch of powerful moneyed interests that want to stop this populist resurgence that we're seeing some indicators of on the Democratic side. Folks like Third Way, folks like big tech and big AI and fossil fuel funders that are putting millions and millions of dollars behind the Abundance Project, they want to make sure that we're not saying that they are the enemies, that the oligarchs are the enemies. They would much rather the Democratic Party keep a focus on or have an increased focus on the enemies being bureaucracy, red tape, liberalism. And so it is concerning that at a moment when it feels like the need for populism is so clear, it's so hard to, in any sort of reality-based empirical way, say that this is not where the Democratic Party needs to be going. And yet it's a hard fight. We know how hard it is to take on the Democratic elites, right? It's not easy. Every marginal thing matters. And for them to be putting this forward as an alternative, as a way for Democrats to like glob onto this because it's an easier thing to do than to say anything that's going to piss off their donors, it's one more challenge in a very challenging project of remaking the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I'm glad you brought up that political point, Aaron. I think both you and Professor Weber cited the Elon Musk retweeting of Ezra Klein on Jon Stewart's show, kind of yes-anding it. And as you pointed out in your article and just now, you say groups like Third Way, which are largely funded by billionaires and corporations, have been major boosters of the policy. And then you go on to include a lengthy quote from Thompson on the Lex Fridman show, basically saying exactly the conspiratorial part out loud, that there is a fight for the, to quote our former president, there is a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party afoot, and we don't want it to be the oligarch-tour folks who are generating a great deal of enthusiasm around ideas that will hurt the donor class. We want it to be about this deregulatory, Reagan-y approach that basically compels the public to say, well, you think building more housing is a bad thing? You know, confronts them with this idea, but this is an obviously good thing. More houses is a good thing. To build more houses, you have to take away the barriers to having more houses. But this is where it gets really dark when you're actually reading the book. And I want to come to you, Isabella. It starts off with this utopian image of the future. And the audience knows I'm a big Trekkie. It was giving, you know, San Francisco, you know, 300 years in the future, post-World War III Star Trek vibes, where it's all solar panels and clean energy and green laws and ships whizzing by the Golden Gate Bridge. But what becomes very clear as you're reading the book is what they allude to but don't get specific on, what they point to as the enemy, and then what they sidestep as the enemy. So as Aaron has already pointed out, it's not about oligarchy, it's not about billionaires, it's not about the profit incentive and its role in driving or not driving housing, affordable housing in particular. It's about affluent suburbanites, NIMBYs who oppose housing because they don't want projects or low-income housing being built in their neighborhood. It's about this imagined liberal with a coexist sign or Black Lives Matter sign in their front yard who is opposing policies to build. It's about silly regulations like having air quality standards for housing built next to highways. And you start to get the impression that there's almost no regulation or no public safety concern or no OSHA concern or no fair labor concern that should preclude in their mind the priority of building housing at any cost. And it read to me like these were presented as trade-offs implicitly without really having the cojones to say, I actually think OSHA is bad. I actually don't think we should have labor law. I actually don't think we should have environmental law. What was your take on this, Professor Weber?
So there is a lot of implicit trade-offs that aren't being spelled out. And if you spelled them out, it would sound very brutal and ugly, right? You would kind of leave the world of abundance and happy-go-lucky feeling that the book conveys with, I don't know, drones delivering fresh fruit over a green lawn that has been watered by water that has been purified from the sea and so on, right? Like once you spell out these trade-offs in an explicit fashion, you are no longer in the kind of suburb went green and now accessible for everybody, wonderful world, but you're in a pretty ugly world of like, are we gonna loosen the regulations on air purification for people who are gonna live next to highways in order to build more and then maybe risk higher cancer rates, risk, I mean, there's a whole lot of research, for example, on pollution and education attainment, how like early childhood exposure to pollution already like undermines education attainments later on because it has all sorts of health impacts that we don't even fully grasp. Just to like say, like once you start spelling this out, it becomes very ugly and the power question can no longer be avoided. And the question of who loses and who wins and who is being protected and who is not being protected then kind of becomes forefront. But I want to take a step back for a second, adding to what Aaron and Sandeep have been saying. So I think, in a way, yes, this is about the Democratic Party, but the claim of the book, I mean, in a quite explicit way in the introduction, is actually bigger than that, right? Like they are claiming that this is the moment where ideas once regarded as implausible and unacceptable become possible and even inevitable. This is a quote. And that in this kind of context, we are actually searching for, quote, a new political order, right? So they are actually making it quite explicit that this is the moment where the old status quo is crumbling, where we are in search for a new status quo, where we are in search for a new kind of economic order. And I think that part of the analysis is very apt. I think we are in such a moment, right? I mean, Trump is absolutely horrific, but Trump is not a US phenomenon, right? Like, this is a global phenomenon. We are at a moment where the threat of fa fascism is as real as it hasn't been since the late 20s, 1930s. So, we are at this moment where we urgently need a new vision for a democratic with small d economic order that can lead us out of this dead end that we have arrived in, where basically the far right has captured the imagination of ordinary people, of the majority of people in some places, as the only parties, the only forces that provide real alternatives to the status quo. People are fed up with what they have. They are like kind of anything but what we have. And the only ones who go out and say, here's something that is portrayed as being generally different is the far right. And of course, the oligarchy tour and so on, we see like inklings of that, like sprouts of that on the left, but nothing as articulate, nothing as high profile, as aggressively pursued as the far right has been doing that in recent years. So I think that this is the real danger of the book in the sense that, I mean, even going beyond the book, if we don't have a clearly articulated vision of the future that is different from the status quo and that presents a real alternative to what the far right has to offer, then we are truly doomed. The good thing about the book is that it's kind of raising that question, right? In that sense, it's a very timely book, but I think it misses the moment in the sense that the answer that they provide is very narrow, is very technocratic, is not set up to actually achieve the task of winning back the people for a democratic project, where they have become so frustrated that they ended up voting for parties that at the end of the day are not representing their interests, as we can see, like in the last months of Trump's government. I mean, so many policies have been pushed through that really undermine the interests of the people who have been voting for them. So that's the moment where the left is also really challenged to come up with a big vision, to come up with something that is coherent, to come up with something that addresses the power question. And that really can serve the purpose that abundance, I think, is not serving. So I hope that we can kind of go beyond just looking at all the little things that might not be great in the book, and ask the question of how could that broader vision look like? And I think that a lot of the elements are already out there, but I think that they also need to be pieced together in the spirit of a progressive alternative.
I absolutely want to come to that. And I want to come back to you for that in particular, because in your piece, you unpack this superficial claim made about how China was able to build high-speed rail so quickly and complicate that notion. I think that provides some prescriptive lens for what might be done in the United States, different from what's offered in abundance. But if you'll indulge me just for a moment more, I'd like to come back to you, Sandeep, because you did a really, really forensic, comprehensive, detailed breakdown of basically everything line by line that's wrong in this book. It was extremely cathartic. I highly recommend that people read this if you were at all compelled by the idea that the left doesn't have like a substantive rebuttal to abundance. I would like you to take on this claim that there is no alternative. The solution that's presented in abundance to how to build more housing, one, would actually work, that regulations are the primary barrier to building. And also maybe keep in mind or bring into the conversation the extent to which Klein and Thompson rely on California as a sort of test kitchen for all of the problems that they see among liberals and the left, and their comparisons to red parts of the country like Texas, and how well that sort of juxtaposition holds up in your view from a practical standpoint.
Sure. So the book features this contrast of dynamic, growing Texas versus sclerotic, dysfunctional California. And it's a little bit ironic that self-identified liberals are holding up Texas as a model. And so housing is one area they focus heavily on, where they say Texas is building a lot of housing, California isn't. Why is that? And, you know, they present themselves as serious empiricists. They're just looking at the facts and making diagnoses in this inductive way. That's how they fashion themselves. And so they say, well, the reason is California has established all these burdensome rules around zoning, around environmental review. And in a sense, the public sector is standing between Californians and abundant, affordable housing. Texas wisely didn't enact many of these laws. So, for instance, they talk about the lack of zoning in Houston, which makes it somewhat of an outlier in the United States, I believe, one of the few large cities that doesn't have any zoning rules. Look at all the housing they're building. So there are several problems with this story. So they talk about how zoning became much tighter in the 1970s in California and really across much of the nation. And so you're led to believe, okay, well, California hasn't been building much housing since the 1970s, right? Well, that seems to be the takeaway. But if you look at the housing boom of the early and mid 2000s, there are actually points where California was building more housing units per month than Texas was. So what's going on here? There's clearly a lot more to the story than simply zoning. There's questions of finance. There's a question of land availability, which all amounts to, is it profitable or not to build? And more specifically, is building for developers more profitable than things like speculating in land or simply putting all their money in long-term investments? And Klein and Thompson don't address these questions at all. They just have a simple monocausal story. Public rules are standing in the way of abundant housing. Texas understands that. That's why they're building a lot. California doesn't get it. That's why they're not building nearly enough. And then you get to, you know, more specific issues. So San Francisco is kind of presented as this paragon of dysfunction. They're not building enough. People want to live there. There are all these great jobs, but it's just too expensive to rent or buy a house there. Houston, by contrast, or Austin, by contrast, they're both affordable places. So when you actually look at affordability in relation to income, Texas doesn't actually look all that great. A lot of people are actually struggling to keep a roof over their head in Texas, because rents are lower in Texas, but incomes are also lower. And in terms of proportion of income spent on housing, Texas doesn't actually look very good compared to many places. So that's one problem. Another problem is they emphasize the value of dense development. I happen to support that. I think density is good. We have far too many sprawling suburbs in most of the country. Well, if you care about density, San Francisco is much better than Houston. Nobody who's been to Houston will say, well, this is a model of dense development. Houston is extremely sprawling, sparsely populated for urban standards, whereas San Francisco is very densely populated, which raises another interesting question that they don't address. Well, is there actually a lot of available land in San Francisco to build housing on? And compared to Houston, no. A lot of the land has already been developed. San Francisco is very built up compared to Houston. So there are all these factors that they just don't contemplate. They don't even allude to these factors in the book. And simply they say, well, the state is standing in the way. You have baby retired baby boomers with too much time on their hands showing up at local zoning meetings, complaining about new developments. This is a big problem in California. It's not in Texas. Therefore, California should emulate Texas. And so they present a story that might be compelling to many people. And the book is written in this very simple, snappy way. So if you just quickly read it, you might think, oh, yeah, this is a coherent story. Texas gets it, California doesn't. But once you actually reflect on the book, read some of the relevant scholarship out there, you realize they're actually presenting a very, very simple-minded story. And I'll just wrap by saying another piece that they don't acknowledge is housing costs are partly a function of how wealthy people living there are. So, you could take a small town in Kansas. Housing's probably pretty cheap compared to Washington, D.C., where I am. You wouldn't say, well, housing in Kansas is cheap simply because of land use rules. You'd say housing is cheap in Kansas because people make a lot less money on average than people in Washington, D.C. And so they don't consider this demand side story at all. It's just purely a supply side story, and it's a supply side story narrowly focused on public land use rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think at one point you refer to it, you say like San Francisco is a superstar city and some of these other places aren't. And I gotta say, as a non-driving New Yorker reading this, the omission of the idea that more people just want to move to San Francisco and there's more demand for housing in San Francisco and the salaries are higher in San Francisco and all of that is a sort of a feedback loop. As a person who cannot move to Houston due to her non-driving status, it's like a little bit missing the forest for the trees here. You also talk in your article, Sandeep, about other drivers of housing costs, including the cost of labor, and specifically when you're talking about the building nuclear plants, the extent to which there were struggles in finding technically able people to be involved in those projects, the cost of building materials. And this nuclear point, I think, is an important one. I've heard it come up time and time again as a argument to undermine the credibility of environmentalists on the left. The claim being that if you were really serious about a Green New Deal or a clean transition, you would be more focused on building nuclear power. And the failure for more nuclear power to be built is a consequence of pushback, regulatory pushback, and sort of political pushback from the left. You paint a very different story in your piece.
That's right. There are a few lines in the book about nuclear power that really raised red flags. So their account of nuclear power is the federal government has been irrationally opposed to the development of nuclear power. Nuclear power doesn't produce any greenhouse gas emissions. So at a time of accelerating climate change, we should be going all in on nuclear. I'd offer qualified support for that statement. And they say the federal government recognized the virtues of nuclear power, we'd have abundant, clean nuclear energy today. The problem with this story is the federal government has been actively supporting the development of nuclear power since the late 1950s through caps on legal liability in the event of nuclear accidents, various subsidies. So if you look back, the federal government has been consistently supportive of the nuclear power industry, in some cases willing to overlook some of the risks of nuclear energy. But Klein's story is, no, it's the government that's standing in the way. And if you look at recent nuclear power projects in the country, the federal government was fully supportive. State governments were fully supportive. The basic problem was the construction companies building these plants didn't know how to build these things as they promised to build them. They had a hard time obtaining the necessary materials and equipment. They had a hard time finding the workers with specialized skills to build these plants. So I'll name the example from Georgia, the Vogtle plant that came online in 2023 and 2024. They built two new units. These are supposed to start producing energy in 2016. They had consistent support from the federal government under both Democratic and Republican administrations. But the contractor, Westinghouse, kept screwing up. So the final plants were 7 years past, over 7 years delayed, and tens of billions of dollars over initial estimated costs. So the private company just didn't know how to build these units. And it wasn't the fault of the federal government, it wasn't the fault of the state government.
The private sector doesn't know how to build these things, and Klein and Thompson present a story that's 180 degrees removed from that and fundamentally false.
Yeah, it's so, I'm sorry, it's like the reading of it is so plainly right-wing, and I don't know that I've really, I'm going to say it very simplistically, because I'm not coming to it with issue area expertise, but I do think the reactivity that I felt, at least, and I think that many people on the left felt to this, was it's very reminiscent of the kind of messaging that you have been hearing from Republicans since at least the 1980s, which is that the government is bad at doing everything and privatization will be a boon without any critique of the failures of various private enterprises. So I think more than one of you, maybe all of you, also alluded to the Elon Musk example, the enormous amount of money that has been poured into his businesses, and the result being basically that SpaceX has taken the place, has basically constructively privatized NASA without any upsides, that there is a focus on self-driving cars as opposed to public infrastructure, which is not in line with the priorities of the general public, but is in line with the profit motive of an entrepreneur like Elon Musk. And that even to the extent that there's such a focus of the villain being, again, not oligarchs like Elon Musk, but your random, perhaps in some ways unsympathetic, well-meaning white liberal who has the time to go to town halls or whatever and advocate for their kind of personal interests over the public's interest. It's like a flip of what we've seen so often, which is Republicans who are pro-corporate adopting some cute small business and saying, well, we have to deregulate to help the mom and pop shop, using as a sort of veil for their larger corporate interest. And it seems so obvious that this is what abundance is about. It strikes me as bizarre that it's gotten so much traction and that, frankly, the authors have managed to sit through so many sort of rigorous interviews without really being pinned down on this exact issue. Why not focus more on oligarchy? Why not focus more on the benefits of something like New Deal programs and creating the housing booms that you laud in your book, but which for some reason you don't see as a model going forward?
We know that the answer for that why is because the folks putting hundreds of millions of dollars into promoting this agenda don't want any of those things. They are the primary actors that are opposed to all of these things. And it, as you said, it is very frustrating. And just to add one more piece to Sandeep's articulation on nuclear and affordable housing, I just want to say that they get climate so wrong. They get renewable energy so profoundly wrong. I talk to a lot of clean energy developers and folks in this space in my job. I don't think I've ever heard someone say that the primary obstacle to them doing more, getting more online, clean energy online faster, is NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, which is sort of the big villain that abundance puts up, right? The two biggest problems that you hear about, one is delays and efforts to block interconnection of clean energy projects into the grid by utilities, which have a material interest in doing that because they make more money, they have more make more profits off of fossil fuel infrastructure than off of more distributed clean energy infrastructure. And this is well documented. Again, I don't think I've ever spoken to a clean energy developer who would not say, yeah, interconnection, the utility, they're trying to undermine us and block us. And it's a huge, huge problem. And then second, you know, there's this massive fossil fuel funded network that has been actively for decades working to undermine clean energy, right? It's very well documented. There's millions and millions of dollars going into promoting the false, fraudulent scheme, deception that offshore wind farms kill whales, that solar panels cause cancer. It is this deception, which is promoted by fossil fuel interests, that is causing AstroTurf and folks to come out to oppose these things. And by the way, the abundance folks know this very well. The head of the Niskanen Center, which is like the one of the leading sort of institutions behind abundance, his brother is the president of Heartland Institute, which is one of the like key nodes in the network of climate disinformation that's going to undermine clean energy development. And so the idea that NEPA is the problem here, I mean, I would ask any listener to search, you know, lobbying disclosures of who is lobbying to gut NEPA. It's not clean energy. The folks who want to gut NEPA are the fossil fuel industry. That's who's working to do it. And they're not doing it because they think that gutting NEPA is going to like open up clean energy abundance. They're doing it because they know that this is one tool that is actually effective in blocking the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure.
That's such an important point. I want to make sure I understand it. You're saying that one of the key limitations to clean energy be more broadly used and not just building the clean energy, whatever it is, the nuclear or the wind tunnel or the dam or whatever, but connecting it to a grid so that it could be more broadly dispersed from the point at which the energy is created.
That's right. And that's something that utilities control, and utilities are a big player in that climate disinformation. I mean, they've been a big player in saying that natural gas is is cleaner than renewable energies, that they have this chokehold veto point and they're using it. And again, it gets to this larger question of, on so many of the scarcities that we face in our society, who is it that is at the choke point, the veto point? It's consolidated corporate power. And if we're just going to write a story of how we get abundance and get rid of scarcity without talking about that, we're missing the point entirely, and in ways that are extremely convenient and helpful and valuable to those corporate powers that don't want us to be talking about the role that they are playing in creating scarcity.
I think you just did such a good job of bringing that point out. And I sort of want to float to all of you. Did any of you listen to the Ezra Klein, Zephyr Teachout interview? You're nodding your head, Aaron. You didn't, Sandeep. Did you, Isabella? Okay, then I'll stick with you for a second, Aaron. Sorry, no, it's not a test. I'm just curious, because Zephyr Teachout being sort of an anti-monopoly guru, I think I was really champing at the bit for her to land that in this interview. And for reasons that I couldn't quite put my finger on, he managed to sort of frame her, I think, correct preoccupation with the corporate role in all of this as sort of beside the point. I wonder, with coming at it from with more issue area expertise, Aaron, what you made of how that interview came across.
I think it's fair to say that corporations are not behind every problem that we face in society. And so, like, you can point out some things where, like, maybe there are other factors. Again, when you're looking at housing affordability and you're looking at clean energy, we could point to all of the ways which they are huge, huge factors. And I think climate is one of the biggest embodiments of this. But again, what they are trying to propose is a overall agenda for the Democratic Party. They're not trying to say, here are some specific areas where maybe there are other explanatory factors and let's focus on them. They are saying, I'm Derek Thompson again in his book tour, he said, oligarchy does a terrible job of explaining the world right now. And that I don't know how you look around at the world and say that oligarchy, maybe it's not the single explanation for everything wrong, but like, if you're going to try to choose one overall frame and narrative and sort of policy approach for one of our two national parties, it makes sense to go with the one that is an explanation for almost everything.
Yeah. No, Aaron, it's zoning. The people are hot for zoning. I think the other sort of red flag that came up when reading the book is that they will lump in healthcare needs as part of what abundance could provide, without getting to the oligarchic chokehold or corporate chokehold over our healthcare costs. That seems like an even more glaring omission, to sort of hand wave about this wonderful future where everyone has quote unquote healthcare access without mentioning the benefits of a public healthcare system that actually cuts through all of the red tape and regulation that they claim to disprove of. And there was a recent sort of a dust up. Matt Iglesias, I guess formerly of Vox, you know, has been a big pro-abundance advocate. And there was an exchange with him on Twitter recently with some abundance critics who called him out for seemingly being indifferent to the Medicare for all of it all. I think Matt Brunick, he tweeted, if you take the abundance agenda principle seriously, then clearly it entails at the very least single payer health insurance. This is because abundance is against pointless / wasteful bureaucracy and administration. And Matt Iglesias jumps in saying, yeah, single payer healthcare seems like a fine idea to me, but it won't help people afford housing. Not sure what the point of this is. And I think that response reflects the sort of prioritization of the book that was so rankling. They might not come out and say, I'm against single-payer healthcare, but they'll devote a lot of words to talking about how bureaucracy and regulation is a problem without looking at the ways that the private sector has created exactly that as an impediment to people accessing affordable care as compared to every other similarly situated affluent country in the world.
No, it's really the silences of the book that are so telling. Like, what do they focus on and what do they leave out? And they have this interesting discussion where they talk about
the mid-20th century AT&T. And they're like, this is the model corporation. Bell Labs was so tremendously innovative. They developed the transistor, photovoltaic cells. And the implication is, well, if we just unleash corporate power today, we'll get similar innovation and dynamism. And they just don't grapple with what's happened over the past half century. The reason AT&T was relatively responsible at the time was because of New Deal regulations and the power of organized labor. And those two things don't exist today, or they exist in attenuated form. So if you look at corporate behavior today, and I talk a little bit about this in my review, companies are prioritizing dividends, stock buybacks, mergers and acquisitions. They're not doing the long-term investment capital expenditure that Klein and Thompson assume they'll undertake if the state just gets out of the way. So I don't know whether it's out of ignorance or pursuit of this broader ideological project, they have basically nothing to say about how businesses behave today. And, to sum it up, the orientation of the typical large corporation today is very extractive and predatory with respect to workers, with respect to suppliers, with respect to communities. That's a far cry from the AT&T of 1965.
And Sandeep, don't you make this point also that while FDR supported utilities remaining private, he pushed them to do the sort of expansion into the rural parts of the country that weren't, it wasn't profitable for them to do, but felt like necessary to do country building, which seems like it relates to Aaron's earlier point about how there isn't this incentive for utilities to build out the infrastructure to get clean energy distributed more broadly.
Yeah, so that's right. FDR was a firm believer in this idea of public-private competition. The public sector would enter certain important lines of business, such as energy, invest in that, and then force the private sector to do better. So we're familiar with public-private partnerships. FDR was very much of the mind of public-private competition. So he set up the Tennessee Valley Authority early in his presidency. The federal government built dams across the country to produce large quantities of hydroelectric power. Federal government financed rural electrification, mainly through community-owned rural electric cooperatives. So the New Deal really paired stronger public regulation with direct public investment. The state is simply going to enter certain sectors on a very large scale. And that vision is completely absent in abundance. If you read the book, you would think that the only difference between the New Deal period and today is the New Deal state faced fewer land use rules. Everything else was the same. And that's just a farcical account of what happened. The New Deal was very much about a muscular federal government that was investing and building on its own, not simply trying to entice the private sector to build, which is what Klein and Thompson are focused on.
Yeah. I also like that point about how they frame the emergence of zoning law. They're like before in the before times there were no zoning laws and there was lots of building. In the after times there's zoning laws and not as much building. But also that they don't take into account the ways that public nuisance laws were zoning laws before zoning laws.
Right.
And so they're missing a big piece of and that public nuisance laws basically created a kind of regulatory framework, but after the fact. So you do the thing to harm the land that hurts your neighbors and they bring suit. And it has the same effect of zoning, but you have to let the bad thing happen first, as opposed to with zoning regulations, you prohibit people from doing the bad thing in the first instance. All of that, I just wanted to point out again, encourage people to read all of these pieces because there is the narrative that the pro-abundance crew is putting out there is that there's just this no critical, substantive left response. And you guys have all done exactly that. Isabel, I want to come to you because I think the China of it all is a really big piece. Where China's ability to build so quickly is kind of held up on one hand as aspirational and in some ways treated as though it's supporting the abundance narrative. But you say they have a very overly simplistic reading of what actually has enabled China to build its infrastructure so quickly.
They have this reading of China basically being able to build quickly because it's authoritarian, because you don't have to debate with judges, because you don't have strict zoning laws. So basically, it's like the absence of regulation and the centralization of political power that makes it possible for China to build quickly. Now, I'm not saying that China doesn't have some of these features, but I think just picking out these features and saying this is what enables China to build fast is almost absurd if you just like reflect about it for a minute, right? I mean, we have so many countries in the world that have high levels of centralized power that are authoritarian, that don't have strong protection of property rights of land, and that do not have high-speed railway systems, right? In fact, the Chinese railway system is the one that has been built fastest, the one that has the vastest reach, the most complex system in the world, right? So this is just staggering how one could come up again. Like, this goes back to the point that you were making earlier, right? You have these like oversimplified stories and you project them on a phenomenon that is actually quite complex. Now, I think that the China story is also actually interesting in relationship to corporate power, in relationship to the role of markets and states, because what China has been going through in recent decades is a complete recalibration of its economic system, right? Like, in the late 70s, China came out of the Cultural Revolution. It kind of had inherited a Soviet-style central planning apparatus that never was quite as complex and solid as the Soviet one, but still that was the model that they were pursuing. Then they tried to develop by basically relying on political mobilization during the Cultural Revolution, which failed completely. And then in the 80s, the question was, how are we actually going to develop, right? I mean, in 1978, China was an extremely poor country. 1980, GDP was lower than Haiti or Sudan, GDP per capita. So we have to remember, right, that they have been experimenting with the ways in which they organize the economic system for decades to get to the point to be able to build these things as fast as they have been building. And at the core of this is a philosophy, if you want so, where the state is using markets as a tool. So the state is very much focused on markets in that sense, right? It's not trying to plan everything. But the question at every step along the way is, how can you unleash market forces? How can you channel them? How can you control them in order to pursue the goals that you have set for the state's development? So in that sense, it's actually, of course, it's not the democratic version of FDR, but the philosophy of adding public competition, the philosophy of using market forces in a big state-building project is actually rather similar. Now, when we come to the specific example of railways, this is, of course, like one of the most, by the nature of the project, centralized endeavors that you can have to plan out a grid of railway, right? So in that case, it is closer to the idea of planning than if we look at something like, let's say, the e-vehicle sector, where the Chinese state has encouraged competition of initially hundreds of e-vehicle companies, right? Where in the US, we are basically, I mean, in a situation where Tesla has captured vast amounts of the e-vehicle subsidies, is like basically a close to monopolist on an American company that produces e-vehicles. Whereas in China, you have had like hundreds of e-vehicle startups that have been subsidized by the state, but the principle was to unleash extreme forms of competition, like a race for the market that is being guaranteed by the state through state regulations, like clear phase-out dates after which you can no longer register a combustion engine car, these kind of things, right? In contrast, in the case of railways, it's more centralized. So we have had a system of 50-year plans that lay out long-term goals that are then followed up with 5-year plans, where at each stage, at these like 5-year intervals, it's being assessed how far you have come towards those goals. Then you have, again, like pretty interesting companies that are like special purpose construction and management companies that are joint ventures between central and provincial governments. So again, this is like the idea of actually having a state-owned corporation, which, however, operates across different jurisdictions, right? So it's not just the central planner, like a central authority doing it all by itself, but it's very cognizant of exactly these problems of local blockages to building railways, which is why you create these joint ventures with local entities. And then you have coordination among rail manufacturers, research institutions, engineering centers, and so on. So you have coordination, but you have a plurality of agents that are necessary to actually create the supply chains for the successful construction of railways. This is maybe a bit too detailed and too much nitty-gritty information on how this works. But the interesting thing is, like, this is far removed from saying, like, okay, you just have like centralized power, like someone sitting in Beijing who's planning it all out. And other than that, like people on the ground have no say and there's no laws that protect them, whatever, like they just have to give in. No, there is like a pretty carefully calibrated system that tries to address these different entities within the system that tries to prevent blockages of the type that abundance is so focused on, and that actually tries to leverage a whole ecosystem and create a whole ecosystem that then can build on scale and can build very fast. Maybe one related point going beyond these specific examples is the whole question of corporate power, more broadly, right? And we have seen in China in recent years pretty brutal crackdowns on powerful companies and on specific individuals, right? Which, of course, like from a Western perspective, seems pretty scary. Some of these things are not exactly the methods that anyone on this podcast would probably envision. But
I don't know.
nonetheless,
I have some pretty hot takes, Isabella.
but in any case, I mean, whatever you think about the means, the point is that the Chinese state has been going out of its way to prevent situations where essential sectors are being captured by individual corporate interests. So the balance between corporate power and state power is one that they pay a lot of attention to, not least to prevent these kind of blockages, but of course also to cement the power of the Communist Party and the Communist state, no question about that. But in any case, it's not necessarily anti-market. It's actually an extreme form of market if we look at the e-vehicle example, but it is against a form of corporate power that can rival the power of the state. I want to add one more thought that goes beyond China on the corporate power question. I mean, I think, again, it's worth reflecting what kind of moment we are in. And I mean, we just came out of this inflation episode that was the highest inflation that Americans have experienced since the 1970s. That was a kind of inflation that has been driven by price explosions in essentials, by the prices of energy, by the prices of food commodities, by the prices of shipping, and so on, where we have seen spectacular windfall profits in these sectors, right? We just came out with a paper recently where we looked at the profits in the fossil fuel industry as a result of these price explosions in the wake of the energy crisis in 2022. And we find that the distribution of these profits is extremely unequal. So you basically have the top 0.1% as the major beneficiaries, the top 1% still getting a lot, the bottom 50% basically getting nothing of these profit explosions, to the point that the inflation burden for the wealthiest Americans has actually been more or less compensated only by the flows from claims on fossil fuel assets alone. So we are not even looking at any other sectors, right? So we are coming out of an inflation that has been driven by price and profit explosions, where the corporate sector as a whole has managed to pass on these cost increases that came from these choke points in systemically significant sectors very successfully, overall it on everybody, and come out in a place where the share of profits and national income is now above 16% and was below 14% in 2019. So, in other words, this has been an inflation episode that really has changed the balance of power between profits and wage incomes from the perspective of the economy as a whole. And this has been an inflation that has been so brutal because it's been about the lack of access at affordable prices to some of the essentials that the abundance folks are actually talking about. And this didn't mean that necessarily there were still shortages, right? Like even when, let's say, the issues in the food supply chain were long over, but the food prices were still way up. Food processing firms, grocery firms did not lower those prices when the bottlenecks had disappeared, when the cost pressures had disappeared. No, they actually reaped a kind of windfall, round of windfall profits that came when those costs were starting to come down. So in other words, we are just coming out of an episode where the price problem, the profit problem, the corporate power problem was really at the heart of preventing the majority of people from enjoying abundance in essential goods. So, I mean, it would have already been surprising enough to have these takes in 2018, but in 2025, after all that we have been through, after all the evidence that we have, and now you can say, okay, this is this heterodox economist from UMass Amherst with Marxist equity ideas or whatever. Don't need to trust me. You can go read the chief economist of some major banks. You can go read analysis of the European Central Bank, of the OECD. I mean, you name it. Many, many authoritative establishment economics institutions have come to these conclusions that this kind of dynamic has been a major part of what we have experienced. And that is not just like an abstract research finding. Again, this is the experience of ordinary people, right? Like in polling, we have seen that increasingly the majority of Americans has actually blamed inflation on corporate profits, right? So for them, like this is a salient, very recent experience. Like I went to the grocery store and I was struggling to buy the basics for me and my kid while the Krogers and the PepsiCos and the giant food corporations of this world have been making massive profits. This is a real experience. And now you come out and say like, oh, let's have abundance by removing some regulations on these corporations. I think this is just like, as a political
Let them pollute the
strategy.
air a little bit more next to your house, and that'll solve the problem. Ignore the massive windfall profits over there.
Derek Thompson on the Lex Fridman podcast, he spoke to this directly, right? He said, and I'm quoting, "Our book, much of my writing, is an attempt to do a little bit of a very specific dance. We're in an era right now of anti-institution politics, anti-establishment politics, ellipsis. So what we're trying to do is essentially say, here's a way to channel the anger that people have at the establishment, but towards our own ends," right? So again, like, it's not that they're stupid, I would say, Isabella, that like they're,
It's intentional. He
there, all this is happening, but we're going to
admitted
say this other thing. They
Yeah.
understand that we're in a moment where there's like an incredible amount of recognition of the role that massive corporations and billionaires are playing in creative scarcity. There's an incredible amount of anger at it. And we're in a moment where there are folks in the Democratic Party that are working to use that anger to direct the Democratic Party in a place where it can actually channel it to do good things for us and to actually be have an effective front against fascism. And what they are saying is, oh no, this anger that's directed at, by the way, our backers, our funders in big tech and big AI and big oil, et cetera, we need to distract. We need to rechannel that energy somewhere else. That is what this project is about. That is the greatest fear, but I think there's an incredible amount of evidence supporting that it's like not us being paranoid, it's what they are saying themselves. Again, if abundance was just about its stated goals, then almost all of its program, almost all of its influence and the campaign that's been going on should have been focused at the local level because that is where its program is decided. The tell here is that almost all of its influence campaign has been focused at the national level, at the federal level, at winning, as Derek Thompson said, at winning this intra-coalitional fight for the future of the Democratic Party. You don't do that if all you care about is zoning. That's just not where zoning happens. You do that if you have a broader focus on how do we redirect the populist anger that exists right now that could go into a fighting oligarchy, fight to have a new deal, to have a Democratic Party that is robust, that can take on fascism? No, we don't want that. We're going to do this other thing.
Yeah, let's say channeling that anger is the actual goal, right? Then I would say, well, what they are offering is really not prepared to achieve that goal, right? I mean, as I was writing in my review, we have the vast majority of the American working force in the service sector, right? These are people who are serving people who are much richer than themselves by, on average, every day, right? That are confronted with the abundance that other people are enjoying all the time. Like if you're in a nail salon, if you are cleaning houses, if you're sitting at the entrance of a fancy condo apartment watching who is going in and out, you're constantly confronted with the abundance that other people enjoy that you do not get to enjoy, right? So channeling that anger by some like general a promise of abundance is just, I think, like a project that is, even if if we say this is the project that it's trying to achieve on its own terms, a project that is doomed to fail on its own terms.
I would say that the focus, it's not going to win back working class voters to the Democratic Party. I think that's not actually what they are trying to do. Their target is less working class voters that we need to win back. And it's more the squishy middle Democratic politician that if there is this big momentum for toward populism, they see that it's in their political interest, they could move that way, even if it's not like their core, they're not a Bernie-crat. But if there's this countervailing thing and there's a compelling narrative laid out for a way that the Democratic Party can meet this moment without having to alienate their big tech and big oil and big money donors, that's the real target for this book and for their larger influence campaign.
It's slot can bait. As you point out, it's at least slot can bait. Sandeep, did you want to get in here?
Yeah, I think politically what they're trying to do is they're trying to drive a wedge between the working class and what we might call the professional managerial class. They say, the people to blame for America's current woes are lawyers, they are civil servants, they are environmentalists. The working class should be angry at them for not being able to enjoy decent, affordable housing. And convenient byproduct of that is attention is drawn away from the oligarchy, and instead it's directed toward people who are comfortable, but by no means wealthy or powerful in any grand sense. But I think Elon Musk is proving to be quite unhelpful for the Klein and Thompson program because everyone can see in real time oligarchy in action. The world's wealthiest man is taking a sledgehammer to the federal government. Admittedly, his wings have been clipped a little bit lately, but we see this happening and we recognize great wealth translates into great power. Musk is using it in very brazen ways, but all these very rich people have similar economic and political power. They might be more strategic and savvy about how they assert it. So Musk is unhelpful to this project because even a very middle of the road, maybe even center right person can see the reason this guy has so much power is because he's wealthy and donated to the president's re-election campaign. There's nothing else going on here. And sure, we might have some resentments and frustrations with people who are a little bit more affluent than us, but they're not the real power players in American society.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, on our last episode, I had a debate with Benjamin Studebaker, another leftist, about sort of what went wrong with the Bernie movements in 2016 and 2020. And he has this theory about the need for the left to be able to overcome this divide in terms of their priorities between the college educated and the non-college educated. And the fact that there is this sort of 60-40 divide, it makes it easier for elites and corporatists and, party establishment, party actors and the like, to sow discord against those sort of a populist figure like Bernie Sanders by exploiting their sort of academic college educated sensibilities and to drive a similar kind of a wedge. And we were sort of debating the extent to which that was really the problem in 2016 and 2020, or there were other factors. But it does seem obvious that various camps know that they can manufacture angst against the top. Someone in like the top 20% bracket, the lawyers and the doctors and the professional managerial class, or like look at how there's this focus on Harvard and like the left is put in a position to have to defend elites at Harvard University. I think rightly so because of these free speech overreaches, but that can also get kind of cartoonified into, oh, look at what their liberal priorities are. And like, how do we overcome that? What do you really do with that? Because that's clearly the battle at foot. And I want to come back to you, Isabella, because you were saying some really interesting things about how China does it. And I know that you're not necessarily suggesting that we nationalize Tesla and put Elon in a gulag. You're not saying that. However, what do you think we should be borrowing from this approach? Because what it feels like is what you're describing is that in China, there is a clear prioritization that the country, it's a country over a corporation. The national interests supersede the private interests of the corporation. There can be a healthy competition and markets can be utilized in the ways that you describe, but it's very much the dog wagging the tail. Whereas in the United States of America, it feels as though politicians are trepidatious about angering these corporations. They're all courting bids from the corporations. There's a desire to basically hand the country over to these corporations so the corporations can then turn around and put money in their political coffers and enable them to stay in office. How do you reverse that sort of a trend?
Well, that's kind of the question of the moment, right? China's situation is so different that I'm not sure how much we can directly borrow from China on that specific question. But I think the general idea of creating public competition is that Sandeep has also been referring to, I think is an important one. I think it works in some sectors better than in others. So, for example, in the realm of commodities, I think it can work pretty well. In like kind of an embryonic form, we actually have that with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, right? I mean, the idea of releasing supplies from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is the idea of adding public competition in terms of supply to a market that is otherwise in private hands. Now, of course, if that public competition is too small, if it's not used strategic enough, if it's not used timely enough, and so on, if it's the only instrument that you employ, it's not going to be powerful enough. But the basic idea,
Biden kind of got dinged over that, right? The right certainly mobilized against him when he did that, and the left was, I think, a little mad that he did it so late. To your point.
Yeah, so I mean, why am I saying that I think he did it too late? Because I think he should have bought oil when the prices were collapsing, like when the prices were close to zero, in some brief moments even negative, the oil prices, right? That was actually the moment when China shipped oil to China with whatever ship that they had available to fill up their reserves. The US did not buy on a large for public stock holding at that moment. So if they had like propped up the prices when they were at rock bottom, and thus would have enticed the oil industry to keep producing in the short run. I mean, all of this is, of course, short run. I'm not a proponent of general lock-in with fossil fuel capitalism, but I think with these short run situations, it's important to do stabilization policy. So if they had done that, and they wouldn't have allowed that collapse of supply to happen, then the price explosions that followed later would also not have been as severe as they ended up being. The same kind of principle could work with basic food staples like grain. In fact, during the FDR time, the AAA under Henry Wallace had some of these ideas, which again, there's actually a very direct China link. Henry Wallace coined the idea of an American ever normal granary, where basically the state would be buying grain when there was oversupply or subsidizing storage when there was oversupply, and then encouraging the sale when the price went back up, or selling directly from public storage when the prices went back up. And this is an idea that goes back to ancient Chinese statecraft, this ever normal granary. So for commodity markets, I think these kind of schemes can work. But of course, commodity markets are only a very small part of the economy. I think beyond that, we basically need forms of inducing competition that is not just limited to antitrust. Of course, we need stricter antitrust enforcement and so on. But if you look, for example, at the e-vehicle sector, I think it would be an interesting thought experiment. What if there was a massive public project to actually create some new e-vehicle companies, possibly even in joint ventures with Chinese companies, why not, that produce new kinds of e-vehicles at low prices? That would certainly break the power of Tesla, for one example. I think we also need to have much more analysis and public attention to profit margins. I mean, we have a jobs day, like everybody knows what's happening with jobs. No one really knows what's happening with profits, except for people who are deep in on the market side. Spain instituted a margin observatory as one of the tools that they used to deal with the inflation in recent years, which has become a tool for unions in wage negotiations, because they now have much better timely information over what kind of profits companies are actually making, so that they can utilize this in their sectoral bargaining. I know sectoral bargaining is not as strong in the US as it is in Spain, but I think building union power is an important way of containing corporate power, right? And tools like that can be tools in that direction. I also think that for massive public procurement programs, we should have profit limits on windfall profits, which is something that used to be perfectly normal in wartime when you had massive public procurement, right? You wouldn't spend billions of taxpayer money on public procurement and then let the companies that benefit from this reap windfall profits. If we think about things like Starlink or some of these new ventures in the space and AI space, then that, for example, could be something where you could say, okay, I mean, if I'm doing massive Pentagon contracts with very large dollar sums attached, we are actually adding conditionalities on windfall profits. I mean, these are just examples, but I think like what we need is a kind of a all hands on deck approach to think about corporate power as something that, I mean, and antitrust is an important tool, but I don't think it's enough. I think we need to go beyond and build counter power by offering public alternatives, by strengthening worker power, but also by using all the levers that we have in public procurement, I think is an important lever that we can use.
See, I love all of that. But I'm like anticipating all of the, it's going to be, oh my God, you're doing a socialism. I mean, this is a country that does, they get mad at price caps, at least if a Democrat's doing it. When Biden did a little bit of this anemic, oh, they're doing price gouging now discourse, you got backlash, not just from Republicans, but from, again, this like moderate blue dog wing of the Democratic Party, the same people who, to Aaron's point, are really discouraging the oligarchy messaging precisely because they think that it's very intuitive and catching on. We played this clip last week, maybe we'll play it again here, but of a popular sort of right-coded podcast in which the whole room erupts and basically like, yeah, Bernie was right. We should do more socialism.
You know what your reflection is? And Bernie said it on flagrant. Everybody's the fucking blame. This ain't a Democrat thing. It's not a Republican thing.
Exactly.
This is government has failed the people. We live in a capitalist society where you got all of these motherfuckers with all the wealth. Elon Musk has more wealth than 50, more than half of the bottom of America.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way we live in a society that claims to be the most wealthiest society on the planet and we can't fix homelessness.
Well, in that case, the Democrats' pivot should be to go more socialist.
Yeah.
Which I'm fine with.
Yes, they should. Yeah. That's what everybody's saying.
That's Bernie.
That's what everybody's saying.
Because the Republican solution to what you just described is going to be
deregulate
capitalism.
Everything.
Deregulation.
That's the only way to get out of this mess, because it's a very intuitive. I think everything that you're saying will resonate and does resonate well with the public if anyone's willing to frame corporations as the root of their problems. And I think that is precisely why you're getting this backlash and this abundance Trojan horse to prevent that messaging from really taking root with the Bernie and the AOC and the oligarchy tour. Sandeep, I heard you, I saw you maybe about to jump in there as well.
Yeah, I was going to add 2 points, I think, that supplement what Isabella said very nicely, which is first, you know, we need to think about competition as a tool. You know, market competition is not an end of itself. And we need to figure out, well, are businesses competing in ways that are good for society, or they're competing in ways that are actually quite harmful to society? So I'm by no means an expert on China. The little I know is from reading the New York Times or the FT. But one thing that routinely catches my attention is business enterprises in China seem to be competing very differently than businesses in the United States. So one example I've seen lately is EV companies, EV component companies. They're competing by trying to build vehicles with longer ranges, faster charging times. And I look at how businesses here are competing, you know, take Silicon Valley, which I think is at the cutting edge in many ways. Uber took over cab markets in the United States by saying, we're going to ignore municipal cab rules. We're going to misclassify our employees as independent contractors. We're not going to pay them a minimum wage. We're not going to contribute to workers' compensation. Now we're seeing these AI companies growing really big by committing large-scale copyright infringement. So businesses in the United States are competing in some really pernicious ways, whereas businesses in China are competing in a way that I think is broadly harmonious and advances the public interest. So I think one really important theme in these policy debates is we need to recognize there's good competition and there's bad competition. And unfortunately, American law and policy has encouraged a lot of bad competition. I think one related point, which Isabel also mentioned, is antitrust is by no means enough. I think we do need antitrust. I think it's an important tool. But we also need to be thinking about corporate governance, like who is the corporation governed and run for? And for 40 plus years now, we've had an ideology of shareholder primacy, where everything is about enriching shareholders. So the corporate fire hose isn't directed at research and development or at workers, certainly not workers, but it's directed at shareholders. How do we enrich shareholders as quickly as possible? So companies are spending hundreds of billions of dollars buying back their own stock. And it's easy to imagine a system. We had this system 50, 60 years ago where all this money is actually going toward higher wages, better benefits, long-term investment, long-term innovation. And so the abundance program basically says, we're going to accept the corporate sector as it is. We will lift public controls on corporations and they'll deliver abundance. And my response is, have you actually looked at how corporations behave today? Have you read headlines in the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times? Like, they're directing a lot of money at shareholders. They're not directing money at the good stuff that we all want. And until we grapple with that fact and recognize that only law and policy will change that, we're not actually going to make much headway in achieving abundance.
And are there laws and policies that have changed over the last 50 years or so that have caused shareholder primacy to be the dominant driver of corporate incentives?
Yeah, so there have been a number of changes. I think probably at the top of my list would be labor laws
much less friendly to workers. Unions are much less powerful than they used to be. So labor unions used to not only get better pay packages for their members, but they exercise some real internal discipline on corporations. You know, the CEO of General Motors in 1965 couldn't pay himself $10 million because the union would raise a hue and a cry. Today, that's entirely possible because there's no longer that internal check. Mm. Then when you look at things like securities laws, stock buybacks were illegal for a long time. And then in the early 80s, the Reagan administration legalized them and corporations started doing them on a very large scale. Similarly, antitrust used to restrict things like mergers and acquisitions. It used to be very hard for a large company to buy a rival. Now it's extraordinarily easy. I could probably point to another half dozen or dozen such examples, but I think that gives you a sense of what's happened since the 1970s to empower shareholders and relatedly disempower workers and communities.
This is so good. I'm like listening to you three and I'm thinking, they don't need the Nikon Institute you were talking about, Aaron, whatever. They don't need an Abundance Institute white paper from whoever the heck to figure out what the Democratic Party needs to do next. I'm listening to you three present such a coherent narrative as to what the problems are, how we got here, who the enemy is, and how you get reforms. And to your point, Aaron, it's hard to come to any other conclusion given how sort of not easy, but sort of obvious and clear the solutions are, that to the extent to which the Democratic Party doesn't want to pick them up and there's this enthusiasm in the alternative for abundance, it's very purposeful. And it's because there's a desire not to relinquish the reliance on the corporate donor class. Aaron, as we wrap here, I just want to come to you again as someone who was a state rep. I don't know if you have any thoughts and feelings on what it was like to try to message on these sorts of points and any pushback that you got within the kind of political party infrastructure, and what you would like to see happening out of the Democratic Party that you have a little more faith in at this point than I do.
Yeah, and to be clear, the faith is, it's not strong. We have seen how incredibly resilient the elite, big money sort of superstructure control of the party is. And we saw it in 2016, and then we saw it in 2020. So I just want to be clear, I don't have a naive faith that we definitely can win this and take it over. I just don't know what the, you know, you asked like, how do we do this? We know what we have to do. How do we do this? I don't know another way than to get one of our two major parties. We have a system where I don't think this current system works that well with third party challenges. We haven't seen it work right since the Whig Republican split. We have a very recent example of seeing how a party can be taken over. You know, first the Tea Party wave and then the Trump MAGA wave. I wouldn't necessarily have thought 15 years ago that the Democratic Party establishment would prove so much stronger and more resilient than the Republican Party has.
Is that what it is? Is it that the Democratic establishment is more resilient or stronger, giving more pushback? Or is it that the interests of, let's say, the MAGA wing of the Republican Party aren't so disaligned with the corporate interests of the conservative establishment?
That's very well put. Yes, we have structurally a harder challenge before us than they did in that takeover. That's super fair. But having said that, I don't really know how else we do it. And I think we're in a moment when it, to me, is at least it's conceivable that this could happen. It is so obvious to anyone who doesn't have a self-interest in seeing otherwise that this is where the energy is at. Hundreds of thousands of people coming out to this message, a clear foil in the Trump administration that is so well fit for a fight over zoning reform, but well fit for a fight over, you know, the power of billionaires to control and degrade our lives. You know, we're going to see in 2028 a fight. The abundance folks are gearing up for who's their abundance person and how are they going to carry this message. And we need to win. It's not clear that we will, but I think it's not impossible that we can, which is why I think it's so hard. It's so important that we push back against efforts like this that are, to my mind, clearly designed with a specific mind of how do we stop this thing that is our only chance from happening. I've had experience in the Democratic Party. By the way, when I was a state rep, when I was in local politics, I worked on some things like zoning reforms. Like, there's some valuable stuff there, but Sandeep mentioned again the silences of this book and this agenda. It's fine to have big silences if what you're trying to do is just, if you're writing a book about zoning reform, fine, write a book about zoning reform. That's that's okay. You don't need to talk about healthcare and like the, you know, single payer and the issues here. But that's just not at all what they're doing. In no way is that what they're doing. What they are trying to do is provide a alternative to the fighting oligarchy message and path.
Yeah, I want to take a step back to just to do a little bit of media criticism here at the end. As they've gotten pushback from the left, one of the ways they've responded is to say, well, this isn't supposed to be a comprehensive book. It's just a little light airport reading just to orient you to some new ideas. On one hand, they want to claim it has all of this prescriptive value. On the other hand, every time they're challenged, they say, well, I wasn't trying to answer every question in the world, but also, no, this needs to be the blueprint for the Democratic Party. And there's been this kind of two-step where they're trying to have it always. You know, don't read too much into my omissions because it's not that serious, but also it's serious enough to be the dominant driving factor of the Democratic Party. And to be clear, this thing is everywhere. It's not just a New York Times bestseller. You can't turn on a mainstream podcast without hearing one of these authors on there. The discourse is
overwhelming. Ezra Klein was just at the Senate Democrats briefing, right? He was just briefing them on this, which, again, if all you care about is like locally decided decisions on building, you're not briefing the Senate Democratic caucus.
Yeah, so this is where some of my pessimism comes from, Aaron, because the Democrats have clearly made a decision. Like, this thing, it feels so astroturfed. It feels like, why are random people? I can't imagine not being in this job and reading this book. Like, I just can't imagine the world where I ran to my local bookstore and was like, give me Abundance. I need my hit of Ezra Klein's new book. But I went to visit a friend recently and she pulled it out of her cabinet saying, what do you think about this? I'm about to read this. I was like, girl, why? Like, but so it, I think it speaks to how much this is being pushed, like pushed. And I think that's why we have this obligation to push back the way that you three have masterfully done on this podcast. That being said, Aaron, the Democratic Party has made its choice. Like, and the idea, like, this is them that's doing it. Like, it comes up in random PodSave interviews with random reps from around the country who are like, I'm going to try to find this clip and insert it here. But there was one maybe a month or two ago on PodSave.
So I think the notion that we need to be more aggressive is correct. I think the idea that Democrats haven't always picked the best leaders is correct. I mean, you and I started talking when I was trying to get Joe Biden out of the race.
Right.
It still is flabbergasting to me that anybody, much less a significant group of people, thought that an 82-year-old Joe Biden was an effective messenger for us. And I have respect for the man's career. I have respect for a lot of things he did as president. But you could see him from 4 years ago. And even if he was doing a good job as president, you could know that he wasn't going to be the effective candidate we need. So I think we do have a hard time making those judgments. Also, I have clashed with Chuck Schumer before. Details of that story aren't worth getting into. So I kind of see that. Mm-hmm. But what really worries me is the same people who are pushing this narrative the hardest are the same people who spent a lot of the time – sorry, not the exact same people – same group – the last year protesting Democrats. You know, when, you know, Donald Trump was an existential threat, they were protesting Kamala Harris. They were protesting Colin Allred. They weren't protesting Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. So I think we need to look at the broader coalition message and see what some of the flaws are in that left-leaning approach on policy, on immigration, on economics, on identity politics, on, to Ezra Klein's point in his new book, getting things done where we govern. So yeah, I don't agree with the way Chuck Schumer handled that. I don't think the messaging was strong. I don't think it's been well organized. I do think Hakeem Jeffries did a great job in the House. Mm-hmm. I think we ought to give him credit for that. But what I'm worried about is if we buy into that, then do we buy into all this other stuff that has really created problems for the Democratic coalition?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're getting at something important, which is, I think the Times had an analysis week where they said, actually, the real split in the Democratic Party right now isn't really even on policy. It's about how hard should we fight or not fight.
And he was, in the same like 5 minute span, criticizing the AOC Bernie tours on the basis that I like the energy, but I don't like the message. And also, Bernie was being critical of Dems back when Dems were in office, and that was rude. And so I don't trust him. And also, I'm going to randomly bring up Abundance. It wasn't an interview about Abundance, but randomly bring it up as an alternative. Look, it's right there. If you're like watching it, you can see how it's all playing out. So I don't, a party that is sending out its emissaries to do this kind of messaging seems to me to have already chosen its path. Just like they chose their path when they tanked Bernie in 2016 and 2020 and welcomed fascism rather than imperil the donor class. And so to me, it's like your skepticism about the possibilities of third parties is well noted and legitimate, but I have even more skepticism about the Democratic Party's willingness to do anything other than to accept failure over progress that would undermine their corporate interests.
Again, I think that's extremely fair. So I'm not going to push back on that other than to say that there are a lot of folks who've made a choice, but there's clearly folks who haven't. Like there wouldn't be this giant effort with so many millions of dollars going into it if there weren't folks who felt like genuinely threatened, right? These are not people who are going to waste their money if they don't feel like there's a material threat. And we still have elections. I just saw a poll that had AOC up 20 points over Schumer in a potential, you know, hypothetical Senate matchup in New York. We know there's going to be people running on a populist wing both in 2026. You've got folks like Nathan Sage in Iowa. You've got, you know, Dan Osborne maybe making another crack at it. And then in 2028 in the presidential, the story isn't written yet. It is on us, all of us who have a stake in a future that's not fascism, that's not, you know, Mad Max dystopia. We have a stake in trying to win this. And I think there, you know, our stuff is more popular, as Isabella said, like that agenda, it's not actually something that appeals to working class people as much as they have all their structural advantages of power and media and all these titans. We have some structural advantages too, which is that we actually have an agenda that meets the moment. We actually are talking about things that real working class people care about. And I think in free and fair primary elections, we have a chance to make this
part. Free and fair, big presumptions. I mean, this is what, listen to me, my audience is going to laugh because of the way I was pushing back against Benjamin Studebaker, but you're kind of proving his point. This argument that the popularity of all of these things ends up not redounding to kind of like our political benefit because the establishment is so good at creating these distractions or dividing us up in these ways. And abundance is that. Like, abundance is so obviously the Trojan horse. Abundance is what identity politics did to Bernie in 2016. Or the kind of Warren liberal, let me not start and like start fights.
The one thing I didn't mention that I'd add is I was feeling a lot after the election. I was feeling a lot for the first time. I was wondering, like, is my like third party's not the way? Is that wrong? Maybe this is irredeemable. Yes. There is not a way forward here. And I think that I feel a little more hope recently in seeing the folks that I talk to who are doing elections. There seems to be a lot of anger among Democratic primary voters in a way that there hasn't been in the past. Part of the problem has been Democratic primary voters have been really establishment focused, right? It's not just big money interest. There's I think an issue with our Democratic base or the folks who have been voting in primaries. And I think the way this played out in this last election with Biden, with the cover up, there is immense amount of rage. And then with Democrats like failure, the James Carville rollover play dead strategy, you know, the Schumer CR vote, all of this stuff. And I could be wrong. We will see. I think there's a chance at least that there is enough anger right now among Democratic primary voters because they have seen how this system has failed, how the establishment has failed in so many ways in a way that we didn't really see. They hadn't really seen in 2016 and 2020 in the same exact way. I think there's a chance that there's enough anger and rage here that, again, there's a path.
We will see, Aaron. I know, Isabella, you've got to jump, so I'm going to come to you first. Where can people find you and your work on the internet? Also, you're welcome to respond or say any last words that you want to get on the record.
They can find me on my old school website, which is www.isabellaweber.com. Elon Musk's hell site at Isabella M. Weber, which is my handle there, on Blue Sky, Instagram, and LinkedIn. I would be happy to continue the discussion online. It's really been great to talking to all of you. What I'm taking away from this is that there is a lot of spirit on an alternative vision in the room, and I think that's what we need to build on, because whether it's a third party or within the Democratic Party, like, I mean, we need the alternative vision to be clear and crisp and to reach folks, right? So I think that's the main takeaway for me. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your contributions have been invaluable. Thank you. Hope to talk to you again. All right, I'll come to you, Sandeep. Where can people find you and your work on the internet and beyond?
Sure, they can find me at my personal website, www.sandeepvahisan.com. I'm also on Twitter, handle is Sandeep Vahisan. They can also find me on LinkedIn, which I periodically check. Yeah, I think the need for an alternative, radically alternative vision is abundantly clear. Isabella mentioned Henry Wallace earlier in the conversation. I coincidentally just finished reading a biography of Wallace. He was FDR's second vice president, also served for 8 years as Secretary of Agriculture, and he was unfortunately red-baited out of politics in the late 1940s, but he really articulated a vision and a program for small-d democracy within the United States, an economy and a system that works for all of us, Black, white, man, woman. And that vision, like, as sad as his political career was at the end, I think it remains more relevant than ever. It's something we need. You know, obviously, FDR was great. Embracing the politics of FDR today would be a qualitative improvement. But since we're our side broadly defined as out of power, we can dream. We can maybe dream even bigger. So I would love to see Henry Wallace politics in the 21st century. And, you know, importantly, he was also an early critic of the Cold War. He sought a more cooperative, multilateral approach to international relations. And so we really need a program of small democracy at home and abroad. So I call for Henry Wallace politics in 2025.
Okay, I'm going to have to hit you up for that biography recommendation. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, it's called American Dreamer. It's an easy title to remember. It took a while for me to read, but it's worth your time.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for that. And Aaron, bringing up the ranks, where can people find you and your work on the internet and beyond?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us. Really, really appreciate you hosting this conversation. I think it's a really important one. I'm a contributing editor at The New Republic, which is where most of my writing is. If folks want to check it out, though, actually none of my abundance writing has been there. AaronRegenberg.com. I'm on Twitter at AaronRegenberg, Blue Sky, all the other ones. And yeah, if I sound a little naively hopeful, I think it's just because there. I have to believe that there's a path. I've got a newborn. He just turned 1 month old today.
Oh, congratulations.
I refuse to concede that he can't have a future. I think we can have an abundant future, but it's going to take actually dealing with the real structures that are blocking that and that are creating scarcity. And that means, to me, that means winning a party in the United States that is willing to challenge corporate power. And I think there's a path to do it, as narrow as it might be.
Well, I certainly am hopeful. I don't think of my pessimism about the Democratic Party to be generalized pessimism. And as listeners of this show know, we always end every episode by imploring folks to keep the faith. And so I'll say that again today. Thank you all for listening to this episode. I, as I said up top, have been really looking forward to doing an abundance panel. And I'm so thrilled about this, what felt like a very perfect blend of panelists that ended up populating this panel. So thank you to all of you. Thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening. Thanks to those of you who subscribe to Bad Faith Podcast and get an additional episode every Monday at patreon.com/badfaithpodcast. Take care of yourselves. And as always, keep the faith.